Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point, the Paradise Papers, an even bigger leak than last year's Panama Papers. 13 million documents from the world's most secretive offshore tax havens. As global wealth is concentrating in fewer and fewer hands, here's where a lot of it goes. The latest leak is a kind of X-ray lighting up the dark about Apple, Facebook, Twitter, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and more. This hour on Point, we're opening up the Paradise Papers. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see? What do we see when the lights come on here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Gerard Ryle, investigative journalist, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. The ICIJ partnered with 95 media outlets to dig into the millions of leaked files known as the Paradise Papers. Gerard Ryle, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Why do you have these 13 million? Who leaked them to you?
We got these documents from the Süddeutsche Zeitung newspaper in Germany. Actually, they originally came to the same reporters who got the Panama Papers last year. They came to us because of the number of people that were in the documents from so many different countries, and we were involved in bringing reporters together to look at the documents and see what was of public interest.
I was asking who leaked them. What can you tell us about that? Because it helps us understand what's going on here.
We actually don't know who was behind this. The Süddeutsche Zeitung don't talk about their sources. They gave us the documents, and of course, when you have an anonymous source or sources, there's a huge obligation on the journalists to go outside the documents to make sure that what we're looking at is real, which is what we spent many, many months doing.
What are these documents? Who are they from, and what do we have here?
The 13 million documents actually come from 21 different sources. There are two offshore law firms. Probably the most important one is a firm called Appleby that was founded in Bermuda. And this is a very high-end law firm that caters to the richest people in the world and the biggest companies in the world. It's a really rarefied universe of wealth. And, you know, this is very different to the Panama Papers in one respect alone, in that this firm basically, you know, doesn't cater to criminals the way that Mossack Fonseca, who was the Panamanian law firm involved in the Panama Papers, did.
So you've got 13.5 million documents. I assume this is not laid out like a novel. You have to look at just lots and lots of financial transactions and legal papers to figure out what's going on here. How on earth do you address that mountain of material?
Well, by bringing reporters from 67 countries in to look at the documents to see what was of public interest to their countries. But you're right. I mean, the vast majority of these documents are incredibly dense legal documents. You've got to read, you know, hundreds of pages sometimes to find a name or find a transaction that is of public interest. So, yeah, it took a lot of patience by a lot of reporters in a lot of countries to actually find what we're publishing this week.
We're going to dig in on a number of fronts here, Wilbur Ross, Apple, and more. But when you step back to, I don't know, 50,000 feet here, what do you see? What is revealed in this normally highly secretive concentration of vast, sprawling, enormous wealth?
Well, we're seeing the really complex maneuvers that big multinational firms go through to avoid tax here in the U.S. and in other countries. And we're also seeing that the rich are actually much richer than we ever thought.
The richest 1% of the world's population, we're now reading, now owns more than half of global wealth. The top 10% owns 90%. Get that again. 1% owns more than half. Top 10% owns 90%. Is it just the super, super rich who are working here? Is this their playground?
It's not just the super wealthy. It's the moderately wealthy. But, I mean, you know, the Forbes list every year comes out and we think we know who the richest people are. These documents are telling us that we actually didn't know how wealthy they really were. And in fact, the list is wrong. These people, or some of these people, are much wealthier than they've been publicly revealed to be before.
It cuts right across political lines. You've got 31,000 American clients with Applebee. George Soros is on there, big donor to Democratic causes. Penny Pritzker in here, Commerce Secretary in the Obama administration, but also high-profile Republican supporters, Shelton Adelson, big supporter of President Trump, Carl Icahn, private equity investor. And then you've got all kinds of linkages that show up that people might not want to reveal. The Queen Elizabeth in here, investing through a Cayman Islands fund in a company that owns shares in one of these rent-to-own companies. I guess like if you need a dinette set or furniture for your living room, financing the sale of household items, I'm reading here, at interest rates as high as 99.9%. Are people trying to use this to stay away from the some of the ethical aspects of what they're invested in?
Yeah, the big issue here is secrecy. What the offshore world sells is secrecy. So when you go offshore, there is no accountability for what you're up to. And I think this is one of the probably the biggest issue we're looking at here, is that we really don't know. There's no accountability once you go offshore. So these people are incredibly wealthy. You know, in the case of some of them, they're actually putting their money into what are called foreign grantor trusts. So these are trusts that are nominally owned by a foreigner. So therefore, the IRS here in the US don't have any jurisdiction over them. So again, we have no idea how much money has been accumulated except through these documents, for instance, which is only a snapshot, let's face it, of the bigger picture.
Such interesting things coming out of here already. Wilbur Ross, and we'll talk about that, his connection to a shipping firm with close ties to companies out of the Vladimir Putin's very innermost circle. Facebook and Twitter with Russian investments in them. Can you give us just a sense of what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing here are links basically from the Kremlin to early investments in Facebook and Twitter. In fact, it shows that the Russians were very good investors and made an awful lot of money in the early days of this. But of course, there are links then back to U.S. politics. And at the moment, you've got this climate of, you know, the involvement by Russia in perhaps, you know, manipulating the last election. So in the current climate, all of this is incredibly interesting, very complex, but incredibly interesting.
We were in a globalized world. Investors and investments went across borders all over the place. What's the big deal if Russians invested early on in Facebook and Twitter?
Well, I guess the big issue here is about the use of social media to influence or potentially influence the last U.S. election. So, you know, the implication could be drawn that, you know, are there questions involving and did the ownership give them any access that they wouldn't normally have got? Of course, you know, that's a big question that that needs to be answered.
Were these investors tied to the Kremlin?
Yeah, there were direct links actually to the Kremlin. Basically, the bank, Kremlin-owned bank, was the investor in both of these companies, or links to the Kremlin directly.
So made millions and a front row seat. Apple is getting a lot of attention because what Steve Cook said, hey, we're not the kind of company that stashes his money in little Caribbean islands, but it turns out they stashed a lot of money in the island of Jersey, far from the Caribbean, but very much stashed. How much?
Oh, there were hundreds of billions of dollars. Probably the biggest pot of money ever is sitting now in the island of Jersey, just off the coast of Britain. And what happened there is during the there was a Senate hearings into where Apple was keeping its profits, and everyone found out that they were actually keeping it in a non-domiciled Irish company. And these documents show that after the controversy, they simply moved the money to Jersey.
I've got one of your colleagues here, Gerard Ryle, and I want to bring him in, Sasha Chavkin, another reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He's been writing a lot about Wilbur Ross. Sasha, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Wilbur Ross, a big billionaire, very successful businessman long before he became Congress Secretary, kind of helped bail Donald Trump out back in his Atlantic City days at one point, investments all over the world. And what did you find in the Paradise Papers about his association with investors very close to Vladimir Putin?
What the Paradise Papers showed us was a chain of companies in the Cayman Islands that Wilbur Ross used to maintain a personal investment in this shipping company, Navigator Holdings, that's kind of at the center of the story. One of the key clients of Navigator Holdings is a Russian energy firm called Sibor that has very close ties to the Kremlin and whose key owners include Putin's son-in-law, and a Russian oligarch named Gennady Timchenko, who's on U.S. sanctions lists.
Why is he on U.S. sanctions list?
The Treasury determined in 2014 that Timchenko was a member of Putin's inner circle. He has been closely linked to Putin financially and is thought to be one of his money men.
So Navigator is a shipping company. They specialize in shipping energy, I guess oil and gas and more around the world. Seaborg is a big producer of those. They use Navigator. So Navigator profits from a company's business that's close to Vladimir Putin. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, there's no indication that it violated United States sanctions or that Secretary Ross violated United States sanctions. But what experts from the State Department who were involved in setting up those sanctions after Russia invaded the Ukraine say is that their message to U.S. companies was to stay away from anyone who is considered to be a Putin crony. And Seaborg and its owners were very much a part of what they describe as Putin Incorporated or Putin's business empire.
And again, that means that the spirit of this investment doesn't line up with the intention of American sanctions, but there was no direct legal infringement here?
That's correct. I think one of the biggest ongoing issues, though, is that Secretary Ross has retained his stake in this company while serving as Commerce Secretary. And that means that even as he is America's top representative in economic policies abroad, promoting the America First trade agenda around the world, he's also in position to be making money from Putin cronies as they continue to do business with Navigator Holdings.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting Blue Apron. .com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the Paradise Papers, a trove of leaked documents on the offshore billions and maneuvering of the world's elite, U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, and many more. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists has worked with lots of publications around the world to dig into a pile of 13.5 million documents. First came to German newspaper. Now everybody's paying attention. Wilbur Ross, U.S. Commerce Secretary, set a big spotlight on him this week. So has Apple, with many billions stashed abroad. What do you make of this secret financial playground of the rich? Madonna and Bono and the Queen of England, but also Wilbur Ross and Apple, and learning here about investments from Russia in Facebook and Twitter. If the president is a populist for the little guy, where are his tweets on this? Calls for the two of you, Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank these journalists for the hard work they've put into this project. And their timing is perfect, Tom. Here we've got the Republicans telling us, oh, you know, we need to cut the taxes on the wealthy, the old trickle-down theory, and now we're finding out they aren't even paying the taxes they should be, and we're supposed to give them more tax cuts?
Claire, we've got it. Gerard, how deep is the extent of tax avoidance here? Is that every dollar that goes to these offshore accounts is about getting away from taxes? Or, I don't know, it's about facilitating reasonable international trade. Is it all about tax avoidance?
It's largely about tax avoidance. What happens here is these multinationals, what they want to do is make sure that their profits end up in a jurisdiction such as Bermuda that has a zero tax. So instead of paying the taxes here in the US, they're making sure that in these very complex financial maneuvers, basically, that the profits are elsewhere. They're still paying taxes, but it's much lower than we're led to believe, and it's certainly not the sort of the rate that President Trump is saying that we need to reduce here in the U.S.
And you wonder how the money becomes more and more concentrated. Keith in Portland, Maine. Keith, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to make an observation. It's really similar to the last caller. I think it's really the tax base that starts to get at this issue, and in particular here in the United States. If you can't make a good argument for an inheritance tax, then you're just not paying attention, because this country is just simply not about creating family dynasties.
Well, I mean, maybe it wasn't, but is it now, Keith?
That's exactly what's happening, and it's sickening.
I mean, but part of this, and Keith, I appreciate your call. Gerard, there's a lot of debate right now about a new tax program in this country, and one of the elements of it, as Republicans have proposed, is getting rid of the inheritance tax, the estate tax. If money is stashed abroad, does the estate tax hit it anyway, or is it invisible to the IRS?
Well, it's a very good question. We actually don't know. I mean, it's all about a social contract, isn't it? We want to pay taxes so that we can have new roads and schools for our children and things like that. If the tax base isn't applied equally across the nation, then more than others, and mostly this is the middle class and the working class.
I want to look at the Apple story in particular here. And Sasha Stenbauer, we're going to come back to Wilbur Ross. But you talk about taxes, what gets taxed and what doesn't. Here was Apple CEO Tim Cook. He was in 2013. He was testifying before the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations about the tech giant's corporate tax strategy. Listen to him then.
We pay all the taxes we owe, every single dollar. We not only comply with the laws, but we comply with the spirit of the laws. We don't depend on tax gimmicks. We don't move intellectual property offshore and use it to sell our products back to the United States to avoid taxes. We don't stash money on some Caribbean island.
Well, let's look at that. Jesse Drucker joins us right now, reporter for the New York Times, covers taxes and international business. He's been writing about what we have learned from the Paradise Papers. Is one of his pieces, after a tax crackdown, Apple founded new shelter for its profits. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Jesse, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We don't stash money on some Caribbean island, but it turns out Apple has stashed a lot of money on another island. What do they do? Why?
Well, so I think it's important to back up for a second. So that the testimony we were listening to from Tim Cook was from a hearing before the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations in 2013. And basically what the Senate investigators found was that Apple was putting had accumulated over $100 billion of profits offshore in a series of Irish subsidiaries that were effectively paying almost no income taxes anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was there was a fair amount of pressure on Ireland to change some of the laws that made this structure possible. Basically, these Irish subsidiaries declared that they were not tax – they had no tax residency anywhere in the world. And Ireland basically said, look, we've got to figure this out. You've got to have a tax residency somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so just a few months after Mr. Cook, you know, very indignantly declared we don't use tax gimmicks, we don't stash our money on some Caribbean island, what the documents show is that Apple's advisors at Baker McKenzie, which is an enormous multinational law firm headquartered here in the U.S., and I think that's a point we should get back to at some point, basically canvassed offices of Applebee at various islands around the world, Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, the BVI, Jersey, Guernsey, et cetera, and said, look, we want to figure out a new place to set up Apple subsidiaries, and so kind of explain to us, make the case for why your island should be the place.
Yep.
And they ended up settling on Jersey, which, you know, is true, is not in the Caribbean. It's in the English Channel.
Okay.
And essentially what they did is, I mean, this gets somewhat complicated, but the sort of the bottom line, and they actually still do rely on Ireland in all likelihood to a large degree. But essentially they moved the residency of a couple of the subsidiaries from Ireland to Jersey and are taking advantage of the fact that Jersey is a tax haven and has no corporate income tax. And so effectively they've gone from a situation where they were accumulating over $100 billion in profits offshore where it's barely been taxed, to now they have probably – it's a little difficult to know the precise number, but they have at least $128 billion offshore that has been completely untaxed by the U.S. And overall probably over $200 billion that's barely been taxed by any country elsewhere in the world as well.
We've heard a lot lately, Jesse, about changes in the American tax law that President Trump says would bring – billions home from overseas. Is that what this Apple money is about? Are they waiting for a more favorable corporate tax rate in America and then they bring it home and pay the tax, or they're given an amnesty on it and never pay the tax? And how does it relate to the tax changes that are being contemplated?
Right. So basically what happens is, you know, the way the U.S. corporate tax code works is that U.S. companies are supposed to pay corporate income tax at a rate of 35% on their worldwide profits, whether the profits are reported here in the U.S. or in Germany or in Japan or in Bermuda. They're supposed to pay 35% in the U.S. But the enormous caveat is that if the profits – if the companies can successfully argue that the profits were generated outside of the U.S., they get to defer the U.S. income taxes on those profits indefinitely. And so what's happened is that U.S. companies really kind of beginning in force in the mid-90s because of an action, a very favorable action to companies by the Clinton Treasury Department, have stockpiled at this point over $2.5 trillion in profits offshore. The majority of those profits – are not in Germany, France, Japan, et cetera, where they actually have sales and employees, but are largely in Bermuda, Ireland, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and a handful of other island tax havens. And so back in 2005 or 2004 and into 2005, the American Jobs Creation Act gave these companies the ability to bring back a bunch of their profits at a one-time reduced rate. And the Republican tax plan released last week does something very similar to that. It essentially says, we are going to force you to repatriate these profits back to the U.S., which on the one hand sounds like potentially something that is positive for tax collection, but basically it's doing it at an extremely reduced tax rate. And there are some other provisions that they have proposed that would also continue the incentive to push as much profit as possible into these tax havens and avoid U.S. tax. And not just U.S. tax, but tax anywhere around the world. I mean, Apple will talk about the high percentage of their profits that are generated overseas. But that isn't really what this is about, right? I mean, they're not reporting these profits in the places where they actually have markets and where the value is created of their products and where they're actually selling stuff. They're reporting the profits for the most part now either in an Irish subsidiary that is resident in Ireland or that is resident in Jersey. And it's a little difficult to know the precise tax rate at which they're paying on these overseas profits, but it's probably somewhere in the mid to high single digits compared to, you know, the 35% rate here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, almost nobody pays the 35, but even 7 is much lower than the effective rate most do pay. What's the lesson here then? If you can stash it abroad long enough and build up enough super mountain of money abroad, you can eventually bring it home at a cheapy tax rate, and then you can go right on doing it? You say the incentives remain in place to go on doing it, Jesse?
Well, the Republican tax plan actually will include some incentives that would actually make it a little worse, because one of the provisions that they've proposed is something that would essentially introduce a permanent minimum tax rate of 10%, potentially just under 10%, but basically 10% on profits earned offshore. Now, you could say on the one hand that is potentially a positive because companies like Google, Apple, Cisco have historically been able to get away at paying low single-digit rates on their overseas profits, and this would bring it up to 10%. But the difference is that on the one hand they have an incentive to push profits offshore to reduce their taxes, but there is in the system a disincentive to do that to some degree because then the cash is trapped over there and they're limited in how they can use it because if they want to use it in the U.S., they have to pay the difference between what they've already paid and 35%. If the Republican proposal becomes law, then that second disincentive I talked about goes away. And there is essentially a new permanent incentive to keep pushing profits offshore. And it means that the new U.S. rate that they've proposed having of 20% on U.S. profits down from 35 really kind of effectively goes away and drops all the way down to 10. I mean, the bottom line is that they've introduced two big new incentives to push profits into tax havens.
And therefore push potential taxes away. They won't be taken while the country is struggling to figure out what to do about deficits. Gerard, tell us another story here about the connection between a couple of guys, James Simons and Robert Mercer. People have heard a lot about Mercer lately for his support of Breitbart and Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, but James Simons, very politically active as well. In Simons' case, very active in offshore investment.
Well, it's not so much offshore investment as in actually putting his wealth offshore. What he's done is he's set up a trust company offshore that has continued to accumulate vast amounts of wealth. Again, I have to say, perfectly legally, he's just playing by the rules here. But what we've discovered is probably the biggest trust company ever. At the moment, I think before we started working on the story, the biggest reported trust company was worth about $1 billion. And I think we're looking at one here that is worth about $7.5 billion.
And this is, I mean, you say it's not an investment, but of course, money put abroad is invested. It continues to accumulate there. And his relationship with Robert Mercer?
Well, again, I mean, they're connected from a business point of view. And again, what we're seeing here in the documents is that a lot of the money that is offshore can actually come back into the U.S. in the form of either loans or grants or through philanthropy. That's sort of, again, comes down to the issue of accountability. There is no real way for us to track this except through leaks of documents like these.
I guess what I was struck by in the story here, and of course, Simons founded Renaissance Technologies. Robert Mercer was ultimately a business partner in that, just a recently departing co-chief executive. They're both big political donors, so they've both accumulated enormous wealth. Simon's a billionaire many times over. Mercer, you know, has his reputation for years as a super billionaire. But that comes back, Gerard, into political influence in this country. In their case, they're partners in business, but one a Democrat, one a Republican, but both very active politically.
Well, again, I guess the big issue here is secrecy. And if you don't know where this money is and you don't know how it's coming back into the U.S., then there's, the potential for influence that isn't being tracked and, I guess, a lack of accountability.
Sasha, in the case of Wilbur Ross, is there some further accounting that's now being called for? Is Congress saying, well, that's fine if you're the company that you're still invested in, still active with, has these close business ties with Kremlin cronies, no problem, or otherwise?
There are several senators that have now called for an investigation by the Inspector General of the Commerce Department. And what they want the Inspector General to look into is whether Wilbur Ross adequately disclosed his connections to Navigator Holding, as well as whether there may be any ongoing conflicts of interest with him retaining this stock. He has said that he probably won't keep his stake in Navigator anymore, but has stopped short of committing to sell it.
This was back during his confirmation hearings in January, and Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington was asking Wilbur Ross how he would make sure his official actions as secretary didn't create conflicts of interest, given he's a super billionaire, given his vast personal holdings.
There will be times in which the influence of those interests will be impacted by decisions made by your organization. And if you would take a look at these specific questions and areas of where you would recuse yourself, in addition to what you've already done with ethics, I would so appreciate this.
I intend to be quite scrupulous about recusal in any topic where there's the slightest scintilla of doubt.
Has that borne out, Sasha? Has Secretary Ross been quite scrupulous on that front?
Well, Wilbur Ross complied with the letter of the disclosure rules, but managed to do so in a way that his connection to Navigator and CBOR never came up in a confirmation process where senators asked repeatedly about his connections to Russia. And that's because of the difference between his financial disclosure and his ethics agreement. In his financial disclosure, he mentioned that he had a stake in Navigator. In his ethics agreement, which is where he talked about which companies he would keep and which he would divest from, he said he would divest from 80 companies and keep 9, four of which were connected to Navigator, but which you couldn't tell from the names of the companies because they were Cayman Islands holding companies with these indecipherable, meaningless kinds of names. So he disclosed the companies that he had a stake in, but the senators were not able to figure out at that time that he was keeping this connection to Navigator.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Paradise Papers, that trove of leaked documents on the offshore billions and maneuverings of the world's elite, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, and many more. Gerard Ryle and Sasha Chavkin are with us from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. They've been digging in with a lot of media outlets to 13.5 million documents that, if you take the time and really sift through, have lots of stories to tell. Jesse Drucker is with us as well for the New York Times. He's been writing about Apple's offshore tax arrangements in the Isle of Jersey in the English Channel, just for one. But this sprawls very wide. You can join us in this hour. Are you following these stories? Do they make us look like patsies, suckers, taxpayers, while the rich hide it away? And is this where that concentrated wealth has gone out of sight, off the books? What about all the relationships there and the political influence that flows back here, supported by all that cash? 1% of the world's population now owning more than half of the world's wealth. Where is that? Well, big chunk of it right here offshore. Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, saying there is no problem here. Here he was on Monday talking with the BBC, downplaying his ties to the Russian gas processing and petrochemical company, Sibur, or Sibur.
The company that is our client, Sibur itself, was not then sanctioned, is not now sanctioned, and never was sanctioned in between. So there's nothing whatsoever improper about Navigator having a relationship with Sibur. I don't know any of those individuals, have never met them, certainly not had any commercial dealings with them.
And did he tell all? He told CNBC on Monday, sure he told all. Here was Ross.
The Sibur relationship was known before. There's nothing in the Paradise Papers that's unique about the charter arrangement with Sibur.
Sasha Chavkin, let's just take these apart. You already looked at the issue of how this was known and when it was known. It was in these papers, but in other papers kind of buried. The senators didn't really get what they were hearing. When he says that Sibur, as you say, or Sibur, as he says, was not then sanctioned, is not now sanctioned, and never was sanctioned in between, what's he parsing there, Sasha?
Well, for a company to be sanctioned, it either has to be named individually by the United States government, or it has to be majority owned by people who are under sanctions. In the case of Sibur, one of its principal owners, Gennady Timchenko, was sanctioned, but he owned less than 50% of the company. And so the company itself, there was no legal prohibition against doing business with it. I spoke, however, to Daniel Fried, who was the sanctions policy coordinator at the State Department, who set up these sanctions against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said is, while there doesn't appear to have been a legal violation, the advice to American businesses was to stay away from people who are Putin cronies. That, you know, you don't want to be a person who tiptoes up to that line and gets to the point where you're technically following the law, but you're also making money from people who are part of Putin's business empire.
And remind us again just how close to Vladimir Putin Gennady Timchenko is, and what the other party here is his son-in-law, married to his daughter?
That's right. So there are three key owners of Sibur who are close to Putin. One is Timchenko, who the Treasury Department has described as a member of his inner circle and has sanctioned dozens of his companies. There's Kirill Shamilov, who's Putin's son-in-law. And the third Sibur owner, and actually the largest shareholder, is a man named Leonid Mikhelson, who is reputed to be the richest man in Russia and who is not sanctioned personally, but has had his company, Novatek, which is a large gas company, sanctioned as well for its ties to the Putin government.
That's pretty close. So we've got Wilbur Ross here, Gerard. He makes policy. Now, how could the kind of policy that he makes affect the business of these companies or his interest in those companies affect the decisions he might make on American policy?
Let me take that one. As Commerce Secretary, the most significant potential conflict would come with sanctions policies. The Commerce Secretary and the Commerce Department have a role in developing and implementing sanctions, including sanctions on Russia and on Venezuela. Another of Navigator's top clients is the Venezuelan state oil company, PDVSA, which was sanctioned by the Trump administration earlier this year. If Wilbur Ross plays a role in sanctions policy in a way that has a direct or predictable effect on his own financial interests, that would violate federal conflict of interest laws.
Peter in Smyrna, Tennessee. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think all this is just more reason to pass the majority tax plan bill that they're trying to get passed in the House and the Senate.
What's your thinking there, Peter?
My thinking is that this bill would close some of these loopholes that are allowing this type of thing to go on. And if it wouldn't close some of these loopholes, then an amendment or it needs to be changed in order to do that.
I appreciate your call, Peter. Jesse Drucker, we touched this a little bit, but, you know, Donald Trump is talking about closing loopholes, talking about bringing money home from abroad, and Peter's listening in Tennessee and thinking, well, then let's pass that and deal with these issues. Let's circle back once more to the effect that the GOP tax plan would have on the kind of investment patterns and offshore profit counting that we're hearing today, Jesse.
Well, I mean, I think based on what Peter just said, I mean, I think the GOP has been probably pretty successful at completely mischaracterizing what their proposals would do. I mean, when it comes to the corporate side, this would not only not close the loopholes, it would actually introduce entirely new ones and would both reward the companies that have been most successful at stockpiling trillions of dollars of profits in offshore tax havens, and would provide significant new incentives for them to keep pushing even more profits into these subsidiaries. So, you know, to the degree that we think that this is a problem, and clearly there are some people that don't think it's a problem, I think including, you know, tax directors at some of these companies, to the degree you think this is a problem, the proposed tax plan from Congress right now would not address this and would actually make the problem worse.
Peter says if it wouldn't close the loopholes, then what about a couple of amendments or a broad approach here that would? What would it take so that 5 or 10 years from now we're not having the same conversation again, Jesse?
Well, I mean, this gets sort of technical. I mean, there are a number of, in some ways, kind of relatively easy things you could do to close down some of these loopholes. I mean, you know, for one thing, I mean, I'm not sure how easy this would be, but, you know, on the state level, you know, a majority of states in the U.S. have a corporate level income tax, and that's generally apportioned to the state based on a formula on how much sales are in the state, how many employees they have in the state, how much physical, you know, factories they might have in the state. And so there are proposals to do things. There are no serious proposals like this in the U.S., but there are proposals around the world to try to do that on a global basis. In other words, you know, if you're Apple, if you have X percentage of your sales in the U.S., then we would allocate X percentage of your profits here and tax you on that basis. The same would go for their sales in Germany, et cetera. That would make it very difficult, if not impossible, for to do this, because I think we all know that virtually none of these companies' sales are in Jersey, Bermuda, Cayman, et cetera.
Gerard, I mean, your outfit is writing so much about this, and including saying, look, If you want to have the resources to take care of societies at home, you've got to address this. But these billions stashed abroad, they also represent political firepower. It represents influence. I mean, you've got lots of big law firms and accountants and corporate tax advisors who must be very keenly focused, Gerard, on not losing these offshore tax havens.
Yeah, I think if this is to be cleaned up, it's really got to be cleaned up at a global level, because we've been looking at the issue for the last 4 or 5 years. This is actually our sixth major investigation into the offshore financial secrecy. And we're seeing, you know, a pattern, basically, that when new rules come along, the lawyers and the accountants basically find new ways of getting around them. And so, you know, I mean, Appleby is really just a facilitator. It's a law firm. The schemes are being drawn up by the big accountancy firms and by the big banks. So it is really a global issue and a global problem and needs to be tackled on a global level.
Jesse, you talked about the role of U.S. law firms in this and said we should look more closely at that. What do you mean?
Well, in the case of Apple and the thing that they did in Jersey, I mean, that was essentially being driven both by both Apple internally, but also their use of Baker McKenzie, which is a giant U.S. law firm. I believe they're the second biggest law firm in the U.S., if not in the world, you know, about as mainstream and well-respected a law firm as it comes. And, you know, Appleby, the offshore firm, in the story, we basically said that they served as something, they were sort of like the general contractor in setting up this tax shelter. And Baker McKenzie was really one of the architects. And I think in general, what Gerard just said is absolutely right, which is that for the most part, you know, we focus on kind of the offshore world because this is where the leaks are coming from and because the whole nature of disclosure there makes it easy to do some of these things. But they're really being driven by U.S. and European, you know, mainstream banks and law firms and accounting firms. And I did want to make one other point, which is, you know, the leak that everyone is waiting for is U.S. leaks. I mean, I was on this program last year discussing the fact that the U.S. is really emerging in some ways as the most important tax haven and secrecy jurisdiction in the world, because the U.S. refuses to sign on to new international guidelines that would result in disclosure about beneficial owners of accountants and of companies and sharing information on taxes. And what we were seeing is a lot of money that used to be in places like Switzerland and the Bahamas is coming into places like Nevada and Wyoming and Delaware. And so while we are seeing stuff that is being enabled by firms that are headquartered in places like Bermuda, the U.S. is an extremely important jurisdiction for enabling a lot of this behavior.
So right here at home, your paper today, quoting Gabriel Zuckman, he's an economist at UC Berkeley, talking about the super concentration of wealth we see now and saying the data suggests that most of the gains at the top are coming at the expense of the rest of the population. And then the Times saying the wealthy use the power that accompanies their money, quoting him here, to exert political influence, reduce taxes and regulation, and hire experts to keep their money safe. What we're seeing here is a lot of it safe abroad or out of the reach of the tax man entirely or even understanding where it is. Mike in Maynard, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your show. This is so informative. Sadly, the roof of my car is now covered with my brain. My head is just blown apart.
Careful, careful. Yeah.
My question is, look, our politicians, especially the Republicans, want to blame it on entitlements. When entitlements are created because of this kind of behavior, Main Street is boarded up. My wages and everybody's wages are stagnant. And then we find out that the people that are going to benefit the most from this Republican tax bill are the very people that are driving the nails into the boards over the windows in the Main Street. I want to know why these gentlemen aren't in front of the House and the Senate on prime time explaining this in a, I would have to admit, a more easier to digest explanation. This should be on every station on Main Street, on Main, at prime time, on the mainstream media. People need to know this. They want to blame the poor, the working poor, the middle class for the woes of our financial debt when this is the heart of it. Ironically, I'm talking to you on an Apple phone right now. It just blows my mind and needs to be brought. The cockroaches need to have the light brought on them. This needs to be brought out in the open.
Mike, we got it, and I appreciate your call. Our time grows short here, but stay safe, and I appreciate that call very much. I mean, Gerard, part of what people are saying here is that you've got a kind of a closed system where this wealth is accumulated abroad. It's out of reach of the taxman or even understanding where it is sometimes. And then our caller says, you know, back home in the United States anyway, here you're now talking about big entitlement cuts and all the rest. Does the hidden nature of this lead to a situation where the concentrated wealth just keeps concentrating? And Mike says everybody else pays the price.
Look, I think everyone has got a right to be angry and ought to be angry. I think it's going to take a while. These stories that we've been publishing with the New York Times and also on our website are very complex, and it's going to take a while for people to really absorb them.
Yeah, but take a while. This has gone on for decades already, and here we are, Gerard.
Because the system is being made deliberately so complex, so that even trying to explain how it works is very difficult, even for people who, like us, have been dealing with this for a long time. We've been absorbed in these documents for a year now, and it's still very difficult. We still think that there are many more stories that are going to come out of the documents.
Jesse, do you see a kind of potential awakening here, or does this wealth abroad, stashed, just mean political power that always gets this shut down? You can write all the stories you want, but it always gets shut down.
Well, I would like it not to be that hopeless. I mean, I would point out that actually this is and has been quite a big political issue in Europe for the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., one issue is there just really is no kind of organized political constituency on the other side of this issue when it comes to taxes. It's really the law firms and the accounting firms that drive a lot of policy. There is no kind of Greenpeace for tax justice.
Wow. And so here we are. The money piled up, the stories coming out, and they are fascinating to read. We thank all three of you for your work on this. Sasha Chavkin at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Gerard Ryle, director at the ICIJ, Jesse Drucker with us today from the New York Times, who's been writing about Apple, and of course, Sasha on Wilbur Ross and more. Absolutely fascinating. Please keep up the work. Thanks for joining us today. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.